I feel like Halloween is like the most trying time for interracial couples because like everyone's issues come up.
Everyone's issues come up. Someone does something ridiculous and then, or like, what do you mean I can't dress as Batman? You know, it's like, I don't have to dress as black characters all the time. Like, I could just be whatever if you, you know.
Oh yeah, one year we dressed as the White Stripes, who are a rock band that is to white people, but like their whole thing is that they wore
red and white.
Red and white. And so we dressed as them, and like Courtney even had a wig, and like no one would understand that she was Jack White because like they couldn't understand that she was black dressed as a white person. And it's like
I'm holding a guitar, I'm wearing red pants and a white shirt. We looked like the cover of one of their albums.
Yeah.
We were like to a T dressed like the cover of one of their albums. And no one got it. And I was like, it's clearly because I'm black. Then at that same party, there was a white guy dressed as Sun Ra, and everyone got it.
Yeah.
This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that made interracial marriage legal across the United States.
The court's decision in Loving v. Virginia paved the way for couples of different races to marry one another, and also for the court's more recent Obergefell v. Hodges decision that legalized same-sex marriage.
In each episode of The Loving Project, we hear from a different couple about what it's like to be in an interracial marriage. This time, we hear from Courtney and Kate.
Courtney is black and grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. Kate is white and grew up in Buffalo, New York. They've lived in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and now make their home together in Philadelphia's Fishtown neighborhood.
They met while they were both students at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. While they had friends in common, it wasn't until the summer of 1999 that they really got to know one another. And they went on their first date that fall.
Courtney forgot that it was our first date,
I'm never gonna
even though she was
down.
Allegedly very excited. And she showed up maybe an hour and a half late after rugby practice. And so then I was not even mad, although I don't know why, because it's normally something that would be a deal breaker for me. I was that excited. And we eventually made it very late for our first date, which was at an Ethiopian restaurant in West Philly. And then I took her on a very scenic route home along a river where there's pretty lights and was really trying to show off the fact that I knew the city and had a car. So apparently it worked.
Oh, it totally worked. We went for water ice too after the...
Of course.
That was a lot of fun. I just remember the weather being unusually cool for the time of year too, so it was quite nice. I guess maybe my being late actually worked out because it wasn't so hot. Well, I guess it really worked out. We still wouldn't be together otherwise.
My name is Courtney and I'm black.
My name is Kate and I'm white, and we've been married since 2014.
I think we initially, like, we both knew that we were among the few people on campus that didn't have what I consider to be total trash taste in music. Because I'm very, very selective.
I'm really obnoxious about music. And so is Courtney. And luckily our, you know, like 95% of our obnoxiousness overlaps. And so that was something that we could talk about right away. And, you know, this was the mixtape era where you would maybe, if you had a crush on someone, you could make a tape for them.
Yeah, like an actual physical tape.
Or a CD or whatever. And so, you know, that was something that happened relatively quickly when we were trying to suss out what we liked about each other. So I think that was a big thing.
And even our 5% of music that we don't overlap on, we're still very opinionated about it to this day. We're still just like, I can't believe you listened to that.
Or I'd like to think that we found each other because we were probably the only two people at our college with an original copy of Prince's Black album, which he shelved, and that even knew it existed, let alone had a copy. So I think that was definitely part of it.
Totally. I had friends of different races growing up. I grew up Catholic, which was pretty unusual for the South, but the church itself was incredibly diverse. And then my high school was incredibly diverse. So I was lucky from middle school up to just be around a ton of people who didn't look like me, who didn't practice the same religion as me. I think that was a good formative experience in my life.
I'd say that, you know, my neighborhood and my schools were mostly white, but most of my friends were not. And I did date people of other races. So I feel fortunate to have grown up where, like, I made mistakes and learned differences and screwed up as a kid, where I wasn't like on this massive learning curve about encountering anyone different from me as an adult, which I've seen people dealing with that, and that's rough. So yeah, I appreciate where I grew up and being able to have friends of different backgrounds and family and classmates and teachers and stuff. My mom's cousins, almost all of them have ended up in interracial relationships, also within my dad's family and my immediate family. So I have cousins that are Asian, Black, Mexican. So I think that when you grow up loving someone unconditionally as family, and you know that that looks like different races, it's nice. I appreciate having grown up like that. I didn't realize that that was not common until I was older. I just always thought that it was, so...
Yeah. And then there was definitely, I mean, there were interracial relationships in my family too. And so I grew up with mixed race cousins and some cousins that are white that were adopted later from other persons' previous relationships. And so I always wonder how some of my white cousins sort of navigate the situation.
Well, there's this thing that happens sometimes when you're a white person that's not a bigot, where like some bigoted white person starts talking to you and assumes that like
you're a bigot.
Like, I was in line once at this rental car place, and there was an ad on the TV for blackpeoplemeet.com, and this white guy in front of me, he says, "Well, you know, everyone would be really pissed off if there was a whitepeoplemeet.com." And he like clearly thought that I was going to be super receptive to this. And I was like, "Really? Do you have a problem with Christian Mingle?" And he's like, "Well, no. And I was like, "You have a problem with J-Date?" "No." And like, you know, people want to meet people that they have something in common with. And sometimes people don't want to meet someone that's a bigot. And then he stopped talking to me for the rest of the time in line. But, you know, I feel like that's something that, like, white people do get approached by these, like, bigots. I feel like that probably happens to your cousin. You know, like, people wouldn't assume that.
That all his cousins are Black. Yeah, and they probably said all kinds of terrible junk to him.
And you're like, you said that to the wrong person.
Right. You had the exact wrong person to say that to.
When we started dating, it was also towards the end of my mother's life. So the first time that Courtney met my family was at the funeral. My father and I didn't previously have as close of a relationship as we do now. And so I hadn't ever explicitly told him that I was queer, but I had been out to my mother for years and years. And I didn't even think to mention Courtney's race, because I just didn't think that it would be a factor or, you know, anything that would be an issue. But I did want to flag the gender issue. And, you know, just said that, like, I've been dating someone, she's important to me, and I think she will be coming down when there are services and everything. And I don't know why I didn't say anything, but I just felt like the bigger deal was gender. And I think also just because of, I grew up in a fairly integrated environment with a family where I have cousins of different races and stuff. And it just didn't seem important to mention.
Right. I think the only weird thing that happened racially, I guess, for your mother's funeral is one of your uncles, like, patted my head. And I think he was trying to comfort me, but at the time I had an afro. And he kind of just, like, mashed it because he's a really strong guy. He kind of just, like, flattened it with his hand because his hand was so big. And that was a little awkward. But I've had, like, people try to touch my hair for other reasons and, you know, for I wanted to see what it was like type of thing. And I've, you know, that's not been great. But I think it was more of just like he was glad that I was there, I think. He would have patted me on the head regardless of the texture of the hair. But it was just super awkward. And I was like, man, I have to go pick this back out in a few minutes. Like, it was just a little weird.
My maternal grandmother is probably, she's since died, but she's probably was the most problematic person in my family for many ways. And also just generally did not like or get along with me. And she was in town in D.C. and I had some family that lived in the D.C. suburbs. And so we were going to meet up at this Irish bar in Bethesda to hear this band play, because they have a song about this Irish liberation guy who I think is named James Connolly, and that was my grandmother's maiden name. there's no way that we're related to James Connolly, but my grandmother always liked to think that we were. And so we're at this bar, the band is playing, and my grandmother's been a little standoffish the entire time. She's not thrilled about the racial issue or the gender issue, and also just not thrilled in general. And then the band starts saying, they're about to sing a song about a freedom fighter. So my grandmother's getting all pumped up because she thinks it's this distant relative. And then they mention other freedom fighters. And
first they start off with the heroes of the Irish Republican movement, start naming these names. And then they shift in, they said Gandhi. And then, you know, in the corner of my eye, I see Grandma Pat getting a little closer. And then they say, by the time they say Martin Luther King, like, Grandma Pat is like straight up embracing me at this point.
Yeah.
Like, I know the black person in this bar, you know, she's like, she belongs. She's like with me kind of thing. And that was like so super awkward.
And the nicest she ever was to you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She didn't like me at all. And it's like, some of your grandchildren are like not white. Like, why are you so mean? She just really didn't.
She was just also mean.
She was just also mean. Yeah. She was also, mean.
Yeah.
Your other grandmother is, like, one of the coolest people ever. But, like, your main grandmother was, like, I thought grandmas were supposed to, like, make you biscuits and make quilts and, like, watch baseball. That's what I did with my grandmothers. And I was like, what is this? Why is she so mean? But I think the racial thing, and then once she realized who I was to you, like, first she was like, oh, you're bringing your buddy, like, the first couple times we met. But then I think when she realized who I was to you, that's when, like, the gloves came off. And that's when she was, like, a little nastier. So, and she was never quite fond of me. For my family, the woman thing was more of an issue than the race thing. So I was really close to my grandparents, and when they passed away, I think people felt a little bit more free to make their opinions of my relationship with Kate known. Prior to that, I think I was sort of insulated by the fact that at least my maternal grandmother, who was my only living grandmother at the time that we got together, was very cool with it. And she accepted Kate and was just really sweet. And my grandfather liked you too, in his own way. He was a very sort of quiet person. But I think that, you know, still people in my extended family, you know, at my grandmother's funeral, they were, one of my aunts decided to open up Leviticus and tell me what she felt about my relationship. And even the minister at my grandmother's funeral, he knew how close I was to her and looked directly in my eyes during the funeral while he was delivering the eulogy and said, now that your grandmother has passed and now that this woman has passed, it's time for some people to get right with God, and looks directly into my eyes, insinuating that he knew. And that, like, you know, I should maybe turn away from my sin to honor my grandmother's memory, which, you know, she certainly didn't care and loved me. So I took that with a grain of salt, but it was a very awkward grain of salt. So that was certainly more difficult than the race thing.
I think the first time I went to the South with Courtney, I thought that something was a racial issue, but it turned out not to be, which was, I was out with her family. There might have been one other white person.
Yeah,
but we were asked if we wanted a separate check. And I was like, oh, this is racial. But then I've subsequently traveled in the South with colleagues and been with white people or, you know, whatever. And the question gets asked every time, too. And I'm like, oh, this is just a Southern thing. But I was like, oh, they think that we can't, like, have the same check or something. But I didn't.
Yeah, and I was so used to, like, big groups of people splitting checks. Like, that's really common in the South, is, like, I would go out with, like, large groups of friends, and they would be like, can we have 18 checks? And they would totally do it.
Yeah.
You know, we're like, but I think I can see how you would perceive that as racial, because it's, like, every time, is it hard to, like, decontextualize that especially when we're, like, traveling together. But, you know, people always talk about the South being more racist. I wouldn't necessarily say that's true. I think everywhere is racist. I think just the way it plays out in interactions is very, very different. People in the South have Confederate flag bumper stickers or whatever else. You kind of understand what their feelings are before you approach them. People are a little less unafraid of being outwardly racist. Now, I mean, more recently that has changed in terms of the sort of differences above and below the Mason-Dixon line. But I think in Philly, it's more of like, I'm going to be nice to you, but you're not going to live in this neighborhood, or you're not going to get these loans, or whatever else it is, you know, sort of, as opposed to like the sort of person who would hurl epithets at you in public. I think the same thing happens in like the suburbs with Black people getting pulled over a lot. I know my brother lived up here for a time, and he worked in investing and would have to go to his clients' houses in the Philly suburbs, and got pulled over all the time when he would drive to clients' houses, or they would find out that he is Black and would refuse to see him, things of that nature. I mean, I think it's, there's a lot in terms of racism that's similar, but I think the just like Southern culture in general is what makes it different. Here, it's not necessarily, racism isn't linked to a traditional way of life. It's just there.
So what was really funny is we were just in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, and we got identified as being a couple openly by several different people, which that doesn't, I don't know if it's like in the North, they just don't talk about these things or they don't say it, but there were several instances where that happened. Yeah. And it was, it was never anything threatening. It was like, oh, I feel seen in a way. But I think that that was a pretty noticeable difference this time.
Yeah, I think in public here, sometimes we don't even get perceived to be out together, like if we're walking together. And I've never been a person that's big on PDA in general. So like we're hardly holding hands or anything like that when we're out in public. But there are definitely those times where like, you know, if we're walking through a crowd and we get separated a little bit, or like we're both walking into a door. And there are those little things that I notice, like a white man will hold the door for you and then it'll fall in my face, like if there's like a distance between us. Mm-hmm. And that's awkward, you know. that kind of stuff gets super awkward.
We also sometimes have a, is this a Southern confusion or is this a racial confusion? Because sometimes it's, yeah, like, oh, it's actually, this is like a Southern thing that doesn't happen here. And then, yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. No, there's sometimes it's Southern and racial, and sometimes it's like people from here, like, no, and like, but maybe their parents are from the South, and so you just like really, it can be like really confusing. But you know, no sugar in the cornbread. So
what's been a big battle in, yeah, our relationship?
Definitely sugar in the cornbread. I don't like that.
I've gotten less sweet in the cornbread over the years, but I still like a little sugar. Ugh.
And sugaring and sweet grits too. That was always that was confusing. That's disgusting.
I don't mess with sweet grits. So Philadelphia is a very segregated city, and when we were looking to buy a house, we were trying to decide where do we live, and a lot of the neighborhoods that were Black and becoming gentrified, there was a lot of tension in those neighborhoods, and it seemed like people were being displaced. And we looked at this white working class Irish neighborhood called Fishtown and thought, if we're contributing to economic changes in the neighborhood, white people at least have more housing options. And so we ended up moving to Fishtown. Our neighborhood is becoming more ethnically diverse, and our neighborhood is now more economically diverse, but almost all of the new people moving in are sort of, you know, more middle class, upper middle class, or upwardly mobile. And it's a really interesting dynamic. But when we moved to the neighborhood 8 years ago, it wasn't the case. And we had to really be thoughtful of where we wanted to buy a house. And but we've had some weird things happen in the neighborhood. Once I was changing a tire on my bike and I was bent over and my hair was kind of covering my face, and I got called the N-word by a passing car, and I was so confused. I was like, did they just know that this was a home where a Black person lived and they saw a person and yelled it, or did they have a very poor understanding of like what I look like? Like, I just, it was like, wow, this is bad. And it's funny because I think that people have assumed that any racial issues we'd have in the neighborhood are with older Fishtowners, and that's just not the case.
Oh, it's definitely not the case. I mean, I'd have to say more of my awkward things have been with the newer people, for sure. Like, the older folks, they're like, oh, you know, I've never lived around a Black person before, and it's no different. Like, I don't know what their expectations were, but clearly I, like, exceeded them, whatever those expectations were. But my more awkward interactions, for sure, have been with newer people. I definitely, when I clean things up, I tend to wear, like, latex gloves, and like sometimes I'll wear a mask when we clean out the litter boxes, just because I have allergies, and so I'm very sensitive to like what might set me off. So when I take the trash out, I'm usually wearing gloves, I'm wearing like a mask, and I was hauling trash out of the side of the house once, and this SUV comes through, and it's someone who's like new to the neighborhood maybe, and was like slowed down and then asked me what my rates were for cleaning houses. And I said that this was my house, because I was out in front of my house, and they looked kind of embarrassed and just drove away. So I think there are still people that assume that because I'm Black that I don't live in the neighborhood. And I've had people roll by and yell the N-word before. And people who, you know, times that I've been sitting on my stoop, people assume that I don't live in the neighborhood.
Sometimes it's hard to tell if we're being received negatively because of being gay, or if it's because of race or what, or if it's like because of being interracial couple, or just that someone doesn't like Courtney or someone doesn't like me. So that's always tricky. But I think what I've had to adjust for is like, how can I can't change that there's privilege that exists for white people, but like, how can I mitigate it? So like when we joined Airbnb, my profile picture pulled from Facebook, which was a picture of the two of us, and we would not get accepted. They wouldn't accept our, you know, request. Whatever. And I was like, oh, you know, let me just put in like my work profile picture. And I've never been rejected. And so it's like, well, yeah, that was a temporary solution, but what can we do that's more proactive? And so now what we try to do is we actually try to find Black hosts whenever we travel, just because research has shown that they don't receive as many requests, that people don't like to book with Black hosts. And so it's like, all right, we're just going to do that as much as we can.
Right.
And we don't always find them, but we do it when we can. And so it's like, I think that like what I've moved from is like, how do I mitigate racism, to like, how do I do things that are more positive and proactive? I'd say that the biggest thing that has changed for me regarding sort of how I think about our relationship is thinking about interactions with the police and safety and things like that. A couple of years ago, we were doing the most wholesome activity. We were visiting my grandmother at her nursing home in rural upstate New York, and then driving on to my dad's house. And I was looking at the GPS and was going a little faster than I should have. And we got pulled over. And of course, you know, I think the cop sees a not great looking car with out of state license plates and a Black person, a white person in the car. And he, I think, you know, compared to the times that I've been pulled over alone, the presumption was this is something much bigger than a speeding ticket. Whereas when I've gotten pulled over alone, it's like, you're speeding, what's going on? And just the level of tension and fear and just how intense it was just really noticeable. And when it was over and we're pulling away, you know, I'm kind of shaking a little bit. And Courtney says, wow, this was like the most chill interaction I've had with a cop. And I'm like, this is the least chill interaction I've had with a cop.
Yeah, I was like, woo, that was it. And she was like, no, that was really tense. I was like, really? You know, because that to me is just, you know, every like other times when I've had interactions with police on the street, it's just been, my hair is really short. I don't dress in incredibly sort of feminine clothing. I don't wear dresses or skirts or anything of that nature. And so like, I think that sometimes I'm perceived to be a man, like from a distance. And I think cops treat me more harshly or more of a threat in that way, or it could just be they're just like up for just messing with Black people regardless. I have no idea. But other interactions with cops, you know, have not been that chill. I mean, I was like, he seemed pretty calm to me, calm as far as police interactions go. But, you know, other times I've interacted with cops in Memphis, and a lot of, you know, my Black and brown friends, if I'd be in the car with them, especially when we were teenagers, got pulled over all the time. And cops were really hostile, or would force everyone out of the car, and we'd have to sit on the sidewalk with our hands behind our backs. And so my interactions with police were very much, you know, like, they immediately are suspecting that you're doing something not on the up and up. And so you're immediately questioned in some kind of way or scrutinized, over-scrutinized for just leaving a football game or heading to someone's house for a birthday party or something like that. Like you had to factor that into your, especially if you were headed from the city to some of the suburbs, like you had to factor in like, oh, we're going to get pulled over probably. And that was, you know, you had like a 15 to 20 minute buffer around getting pulled over. So
I feel like I perceive all of that so much more differently now and like just have such a bigger level of fear. And Courtney doesn't drive, and that has been, I think, a big sticking point in our relationship a lot because I hate being stuck being the driver. And now I sort of think maybe it's fine. You know, like that's one less situation that I don't have to be afraid of. We were the kind of people that thought that getting married was kind of a sellout activity and that part of the joy of being queer is being different politically and just not having this very traditional life. And so, you know, wasn't interested. And then when it became legal in Pennsylvania, one of our friends was very sick. And she and her wife had gotten married in New York when it was legalized there. And I, you know, saw her getting sicker and just thought about how hard it would be if she and her wife didn't have the rights that they had as being a married couple. And then how grateful I was that so many people had fought hard for this. And just, you know, the fears that I'm an anxious person and some of the anxiety I have is like, what if we're in Northeast Pennsylvania and get in a car accident and like they don't, you know, it's a hospital that can say, oh, we won't let you see your wife. And I just thought, like, why take this, like, rebel stance that's just pointless when, like, we can do something that makes our lives a lot easier. And then being in a relationship is a hard thing to do. It's hard to be vulnerable with someone. It's hard to love someone and keep that love alive. And why not celebrate our love publicly in front of people? We had had so much pressure from friends over the years to get married. And so I think part of me being stubborn about it was just reacting to that. Like, no, I'm not going to have this wedding. This is ridiculous expense. And then, of course, we ended up having a traditional wedding. And I wore a long white dress. And, it, you know, unfortunately, our friend passed away a week before our wedding. So she wasn't able to see it. But it did seem like... I didn't feel like we were being like our hand was being forced or anything, but
yeah, no,
it was something we kind of just jointly agreed upon.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah. And I know a lot of the times people sort of ask about what's your engagement story? Like, I think like where I work, I'm one of, you know, very few out folks on staff. And yeah, when they're like, oh, you're married, what's your engagement story? And I'm just like, well, you know, it was like not legal for a long period of time. So it was like legal. And then we were like, it's cool. You know, it wasn't, there wasn't any like, and then we went to this whatever and we were on the roof of the, no, there was none of that. And there was, and I still certainly believe that the sort of rights that get conferred on people with marriage should be available to all people, regardless of whether they're married or not. People should be able to designate someone to, without too much legal hoopla, take care of their affairs or will their estate.
Yeah, I think that I was able to reframe getting married from being a sellout thing to like, actually, that's kind of a political thing too. That's like, I'm claiming this right that the government wanted to deny me based on gender and based on race, ethnicity. And so it is sort of asserting rights and standing up for it. And I mean, that's why we did an obnoxious thing. We submitted our wedding announcement to the New York Times because we don't see people that look like us in the New York Times weddings. It's like usually these very like pedigreed, bougie, like,
yeah,
you know, no, fancy totally. People. And certainly you don't see that many lesbian couples. You don't see many interracial couples. You don't see many interracial lesbian couples. And we submitted a thing and got in there, not a feature, but, you know, just the little announcement. And, you know, like that to me was political, that like you should have more people that look not like these like people. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. It's like very well-heeled, white heterosexual couples, for sure. But I mean, not to say that I don't read those. I totally read all of them because it's just, it's a bit of a guilty pleasure for me. But
even to think of the state having a say in marriage is just, is frustrating.
We'd like to thank Courtney and Kate for sharing their story.
The Loving Project is available in iTunes and just about anywhere else podcasts are distributed. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can find out more about the podcast at our website, lovingproject.com. That's where you'll also find pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show, links to follow us on social media, and a contact page where you can let us know what you think of the podcast. I'm Farrah Parks.
And I'm Brad Linder. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Jennifer and Sean.
Jennifer is white and Sean is black. They have a young child named Wyatt who has light skin and blonde hair. And sometimes people don't even realize that he's biracial.
We had an incident where Sean went into daycare to pick Wyatt up, and they handed over a little girl who was African-American. And he said, no, that's not my child. Wyatt's my child.
In their defense, they had a stand-in
who
was in, and there were only two kids left. She didn't hand the child to me. She said, oh, you're here for the princess. And I was like, no, I'm here for the prince.
Sean and Jennifer's story, coming up next time on The Loving Project.